Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by continuing our discussions about the Pandora Papers, a trove of nearly 12 million confidential documents that reveal how wealthy politicians and the ultra-rich use secret offshore companies to hide their assets. The Pandora Papers investigation also reveals how banks and law firms work closely with offshore service providers to design complex corporate structures. The investigation is the world's largest ever collaboration, involving more than 600 journalists from 150 media outlets in 117 countries. Frontline is out with a new documentary called Pandora Papers, and it focuses on three aspects of the findings: Russian President Vladimir Putin using his inner circle to hide his enormous wealth, the King of Jordan using 30 shell companies to buy property around the globe worth more than $106 million, and wealthy people from abroad who are using trusts to hide their money in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And here's a trailer for the Frontline documentary, Pandora Papers.
We're looking at millions of confidential records from within offices around the world whose job is to help powerful people buy and use secretive shell companies.
A massive leak of tax haven documents.
They give you visibility into what people are doing with money that they don't want you to see.
With the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and reporters around the world, a two-year investigation into secretive finance.
We have never seen this many heads of state and global billionaires in one location before.
Overseas and in the U.S.
We're talking about people who have been accused of some very bad things, who are using this system to hide their wealth in the United States.
The revelations of the Pandora Papers.
That is a trailer for the new Frontline documentary, Pandora Papers. You can watch it online now. Find a clip at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Evan Williams, an award-winning print, radio, and TV journalist, and one of the producers of Pandora Papers. Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, thanks to you and your team for another great documentary.
Good morning, Rose. Great to hear from you and great to be in touch.
Great to have you on. Will Fitzgibbon is senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. For close to 2 years, the ICIJ has led an investigation into these leaked documents, and Will is featured in the film. Hi, Will. Thank you for joining us. Great to have you back.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Well, I have to say, it's one thing to talk about the papers and to read about the papers, but to see it is a completely different experience. So thank you both for your great work. It's so important. Will, I want to start off with you. It's been about 2 months since the publication of the Pandora Papers, and we just got word that lawmakers in Chile voted to impeach their president following revelations in the papers about a possible conflict of interest in the sale of a mining company by his children to a close associate. What are your thoughts so far about the fallout of these papers?
Well, I think it reminds me a lot of that song by the Carpenters I like, "It's Only Just Begun." You know, as you say, it's been a few months. We've seen investigations and inquiries, including against politicians and even presidents in Chile, but also in Ecuador. We've seen politicians summoned for questioning in countries like Bulgaria. Of course, the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, 1 week after the Pandora Papers revelations that exposed his luxury French property, he narrowly lost an election he was expected to win. And also in the United States, we've seen a lot more reaction and impact than I thought many of us, myself included, thought we would. You know, lawmakers have introduced a bill into Congress already, both Republicans and Democrats, calling for changes as a result of the Pandora Papers disclosures. And that's just to start with. I mean, these kind of investigations are so complicated. And my experience is it takes months and even years for, you know, for criminal actions to be taken and for the full truth of what we've revealed to really be taken up by criminal and other law enforcement around the world.
What about you, Evan? What really strikes you about the coverage so far and the fallout?
I think the coverage is extraordinary. As you've already correctly pointed out, this is a massive collaboration, a unique journalistic exercise and journey, really, with 650 journalists who, you know, our nature is normally to hide our stories until we post them exclusively. But this is exactly the opposite. And the power is extraordinary. Being involved in the machine of sharing this information and then picking up leads from other people, and then other journalists picking up more information and being able to feed back in. Really, this is the strength of it, and it's quite extraordinary. And I think the coverage has been global. The impact is rolling on and will only get bigger. And I think, 12 million documents is really, this is just the beginning. This trove of information will continue to be mined for months, if not years to come.
Evan, you spoke, in addition to Will in your film, you have Washington Post reporters Debbie Kenzipur and Greg Miller. What really struck you about just what it takes as a journalist to go through so many documents and find crucial information? I mean, for example, we'll talk more about Putin, but just the fact that one woman's name, just the name, brought up so much information. But then again, you have to do your due diligence and you have to fact check all of it. I mean, there's just so much involved in all of this.
Yeah, there really is. And I'm reminded by an interesting comment. The way we approached this was to try and tell the story of the investigation to a degree, as much as it was the facts that were being uncovered as well. So we made it a journey in that way. And I remember we did this by having very many Zoom calls with people like Will and with Debbie and Greg, just to sort of update ourselves as we went along. And I remember the very first conversation I had with Debbie, where she'd just started, just got access to the ICIJ's superb database where all these documents are sitting and organized. And she just said, look, frankly, I'm a bit overwhelmed. And right. I spent a month myself very early on looking through the documents. It's very hard to keep your attention, to keep your focus. And, this is where Will and his team have an extraordinary talent in being able to keep going, keep digging, look for that name, look for that link, that lead. And often, I think Will may back me up on this, but I think it's often, and Greg Miller says this in the film too, that the documents themselves may be the beginning of a story. And then you look at what's being reported on that individual or that institution, and then you might be able to work out that actually the documents give you that missing piece that fills in a blank and actually makes the story. And you mentioned there Svetlana, the woman Svetlana Kvivonogig, which is a classic case where basically, very briefly, as the documents were starting to be investigated by journalists, there was a Russian investigative website called Proact, which went public on an investigation into Svetlana. And she was started as a cleaner, and all of a sudden it's alleged that she was Putin's mistress. Within about 5 months or months after that, she was acquiring assets around Russia. They estimated to be worth some $100 million. Now, the accusation there is, or the claim, is it her money, or is it actually a way that President Putin is hiding his money? So they tapped in Svetlana Kvivonogig into the ICIJ database, and they found that she was the owner of two or three shell companies. And then they found that there was only one reference to Monaco. And one of the Guardian journalists from Britain, Luke Harding, then worked out through the property records in Monaco what those companies, those shell companies, owned. And they found it was a 3.6 million euro apartment in a very, very nice part of Monaco. So that's sort of how these things work. But Will knows a lot more than I do.
Will, what would you like to add?
Look, well, I've certainly become a lot. My eyesight's deteriorated significantly after 2 years of looking through all of these leaked documents. But Evan's absolutely right. I think, this isn't a document dump. Politicians and even criminals who use this offshore secret financial world, they're not foolish enough to write in an email, "Hello, I've stolen money. Can you please help me hide it?" Right? So reporters aren't given this kind of story on a platter. We spend months and even years of our life piecing pieces together. It might not be the name of a politician that we find, but maybe it's their wife or their mistress or their daughter or even a limousine driver sometimes, people who are entrusted to hide assets on their behalf. And that's exactly what ICIJ and reporters spend so much time doing, is piecing those bits of the puzzle together. And that's how we get to these stories. And there are so many of them. And as Evan said, there'll be a lot more to come.
Will, you made such an important point in the documentary, because the one thing I've been thinking about is, at a time when massive inequality is rising around the world and people are struggling to make ends meet, in so many countries around the globe, you say we're seeing very powerful people who are hiding, trying to hide the fact that they're ultra rich from their own citizens who often live in poverty. And this revealed that more than 300 public officials around the world, and then 14 cases involving current leaders. So can you please elaborate on that important point?
Sure. And I think the point starts with acknowledging that a lot of what we see in the Pandora Papers isn't necessarily illegal. It's not outright criminal action. But it doesn't need to be criminal for it to be incredibly important for us to pay attention to. The fact that world leaders have amassed wealth and have hidden this wealth from their citizens, in some cases citizens who elect them to office, really, on a scale that I don't think any of us had ever thought possible before, is incredibly sobering. You know, it reminds us of this two-tier economy in which we live, the economy in which you, Evan, and I presumably live. You know, if we want to buy a house, we buy it in our own name. We don't hide it through a shell company. We don't really have the ability to pay $50,000 a year to fancy lawyers or accountants who can help us design secretive structures that help us reduce or even avoid taxes entirely. And yet, of course, that's what the entire offshore system exists to do. The entire offshore system exists to serve the 1 or 0.1% of the world's wealthiest and most powerful individuals who, because of that wealth and power, really can almost choose the laws that they want to abide by. You don't want to pay income tax, or you want to pay less income tax in the country you're from? Hey, contact a lawyer in the British Virgin Islands or South Dakota, and maybe you can get away with paying less. And I think that's what the Pandora Papers is about, that ultimately this offshore financial system plays an incredibly central role in the ongoing and deepening inequality that we see, not just in America, but in every country around the world.
So we have about 15 minutes left. Let's talk about the three aspects of the documentary. And also, what was so interesting about the Vladimir Putin section of the documentary is, Evan, you mentioned the woman, you told us about Svetlana Karanovich. And Greg Miller of the Washington Post said he thought this was one of the most fascinating stories in the papers because it allows reporters, it really gave them fresh evidence of how those close to Vladimir Putin were amassing their hidden fortunes abroad. So basically what these papers reveal and what journalists have been, you know, obviously have been reporting is that Putin uses his inner circle to hide his wealth, but a lot of these people in the inner circle then take that wealth abroad.
You're absolutely right. And this is a really, really good example of how the documents cracked open that door. I mean, up until this point, let's take Svetlana, for example. Up until this point, the Russian investigative journalists only really clocked her assets in Russia. Nobody knew that she was owning any property offshore, outside Russia at all. And it then went one step further, because in the documents, again, we find that the company that helped set up this, and this talks exactly to Will's point, the company that set up the shell companies for Svetlana had also set up shell companies for two other individuals who were very, very close to Vladimir Putin. And those individuals had been sanctioned by the US State Department for their very closeness to President Putin, and they, as a result of the invasion of Crimea, and they have amassed vast wealth through these offshore shell companies, this secretive system. So we all of a sudden not just find an individual with an interesting apartment. You see the beginnings. The window is opened a little bit on a system that's in place helping at least now three individuals very close to the president amass vast fortunes offshore. So what else is there is a question. But it does reveal more about the inner circle of Vladimir Putin, at least amassing vast wealth. Some of them have come from very modest backgrounds, Svetlana and another man called Peter Colman in particular. So where does the money come from, and what is that money exactly? And as Greg Miller of the Washington Post says in the film, U.S. State Department officials, intelligence officials and others strongly believe that they are what's called wallets, and they are hiding President Putin's wealth for him. Very hard to prove, very hard to see that exactly in black and white, but that is the suspicion. And I think that the story that was uncovered in Monaco takes that one step further quite significantly.
And we're talking about a lot of money here. I mean, as you point out, the investigative website ProAct has estimated that Svetlana's assets in Russia alone are about $100 million. And then another Putin associate, Gennady Timchenko, he's been accused of using his connections to Putin to amass an oil trading fortune estimated at $20 billion with a B. So yeah. Can you talk more about... You know, journalists living in places like Russia, where it's so hard to keep people like Putin, to hold him accountable, how are they using this information, and how is this being, how is the Russian public responding to this? Do either of you know?
Yeah, I mean, there, I'll come in there briefly, and then Will may know more, because he's coordinating this for the ICIJ. But let's take that as it's a very, very important point, because the ProAct investigators, anybody that basically investigates President Putin personally in this way, it comes under extraordinary pressure. And the ProAct website has now basically been taken down. The manager, I believe, has had to leave the country. We spoke to other Russian collaborators, colleagues of ours, who are under extraordinary pressure and were under the belief that that in fact they would be targeted next. There are laws being put in place against all independent media in Russia as we speak, which is not effective, not quite making them illegal, but certainly putting them under extraordinary pressure where they've got to report in, they've got to report about their revenue, they've got to report about what they're doing, and they can be sanctioned with jail sentences. The next thing is you could be accused of being, acting against the state. So it's a very, very serious high-stakes game for journalists in Russia, particularly right now. So anything like this that targets the president really gets you in the spotlight, and as we've seen that happen. So I haven't seen what's happened as a result of the media coverage in Russia, but I know that they were following some big stories themselves there as well. And it all adds up, you know, it's an aggregate feel. These ideas get into the public view, and they just keep creeping up on the institutions, not just in Russia but other places. Mm.
Anything to add on that one, Will?
No, I think all I'd say is that the reporters who are working on this project do so in incredibly challenging situations around the world. You know, these are the secrets that the world's rich and powerful never wanted anyone to see. No president wants the public to know the luxury Malibu mansions that they own, for example. And therefore, we've seen, unfortunately, very negative reactions against journalists from Ecuador to Russia to Sri Lanka, for example. But that's exactly why we do these collaborations in the numbers that we do, because it's a lot harder to silence the voice of one journalist than it is silence the voice of 600 journalists. Hmm.
Will Fitzgibbon is a senior reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. For 2 years, they have led an investigation into the Pandora Papers documents. Evan Williams is an award-winning print, radio, and TV journalist and one of the producers of the new Frontline documentary, Pandora Papers, and you can watch it online now. Let's talk now about the King of Jordan. And the last time we did a show about the Pandora Papers, we briefly discussed this. But again, just to see it, it's a completely different story. So as the Washington Post, Greg Miller points out, Jordan is a huge U.S. ally. It's a huge supporter of U.S. policies in the Middle East. The U.S. gives Jordan more than $1 billion in aid every year. And the documents found that while Jordan was undergoing increasing economic hardship, the King of Jordan was making secretive transactions using a network of offshore accounts, a total of 30. And he's got massive properties in Malibu, in London, and around the globe. Will, what really struck you about this section of the documentary and what you found?
Well, I think what struck me so much looking through these documents was the scale of it. You know, how one king literally owns 3 adjacent properties in Malibu, California, on a very exclusive street. These are huge mansions overlooking the sea, you know, swimming pools, fancy carports, you know, the kind of place any of us would love to visit on a holiday. But not only did he own these, but he bought them through very secretive shell companies. We wouldn't know that the King of Jordan owned these US properties if not for the Pandora Papers. And really the question once again is why? Why does a king need to go through all of these layers of secrecy to hide $60 million worth of property from his people? And I think many experts said part of the answer, at least, might lie in the fact that his own people are going through an incredibly difficult economic time. You know, there were literally protests in the street in which Jordanian citizens were calling the King of Jordan or likening him to Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, for example. And at the same time, the king was buying these luxury properties. And that's exactly the kind of thing that this secretive offshore industry facilitates, as the Pandora Papers shows.
What about you, Evan? What struck you about this section of the documentary?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, on the surface of it, he's a king, not necessarily from a very rich background, in fact, but he's a king. And so you expect, okay, maybe a few properties around the world is sort of understandable. So when we started looking at this, we did so with a very open mind. And it was like, is this really a story? I mean, what is this? And it comes back to Will's point. It's all done so secretly. Now, and not only that, you know, it's close to $100 million worth of property in very exclusive parts in London. I've been to them myself and had a look from the outside, I must hasten to add, but in Malibu and in Washington. So what's going on here? And none of these places had any official markings, or they weren't like residences or anything like that that would be used ostensibly for official engagements, although there's a complication slightly to that story. So the issue was secrecy. Why such secrecy? Why these properties in this particular area? Why Malibu? What's really going on there? And obviously we gave them the king and his and the palace the opportunity to respond. They said, well, look, you know, it's for these properties are used for the king and his family. They're used, the secrecy is to protect the security of him and his family. And then we got a second, after the publication, early in October, we got a second letter from the Hashemite Palace in Amman in Jordan saying, oh, actually, some of these properties are sometimes used for official engagements as well as private issues, which was an interesting change in the official version of events. So, you know, we don't really know what's going on there other than the documents have proven this vast property holding secretly held offshore by the king. And in some of the documents, even the officials setting this up for him don't refer to him by name. They only refer to him as you-know-who, as we found out in the investigation. So a lot of secrecy involved.
Can either of you talk about why real estate is such a convenient way to hide money?
Well, I think Will may know more than I do, but I think it's if you look at, take for example, London. I mean, London is a notorious place for money to come in from various shady places offshore, particularly Russia, in fact. And it's a convenient and a very easy way to actually, if you needed to wash the source of that money, you put it into a squillion pound property in London, you can sell it at the other end, and you know that's the new source of the money. So that's one reason. The second one is it's obviously secure. You know, it's a secure asset. It's unlikely to go too far down. And it's a good place to park your cash for a while. And I think we see, you know, various people around the world putting it into it. What was interesting about the king was the Malibu properties, because London, you know, New York, you can sort of see that. But these Malibu properties really stuck out there on the cliff. That was quite something.
You know, I found a piece in Foreign Policy by Daoud Khatab, the Director General of the Community Media Network, which runs Radio Al-Abad and the news site AmanNet in Jordan. And he wrote, as far as I'm aware, we had been the only media outlet in all of Jordan to report on Abdullah's implication in the Pandora Papers. And for all of 3 hours, many Jordanians had been able to read in Arabic about the luxury properties owned by their king. Then the page went dark, and they turned again to articles by the Washington Post and other foreign, including non-Jordanian outlets.
Yeah.
Have either of you been following this?
Yes, we heard that the Washington. We heard also that the Washington Post website itself was blocked in Jordan for a few hours. I haven't independently substantiated that, but there was definitely a lot of nervousness officially in Jordan. I mean, this is potentially incendiary, because a lot of people are doing it pretty tough in Jordan, and there's no evidence that the $1 billion a year that America sends to Jordan is in any way being used in this way. But just the fact that it is so aid dependent, and just the fact that people are doing it tough, raises the question about, well, if the king can spend $100 million of his own money and luxury property abroad, I think Jordanians would be reasonably asking a question, couldn't some of that money be best spent at home? And maybe there'll be questions in Congress about should America be spending that much money there as well.
Right. Well,
I was going to say, and isn't that one of the big questions for so many of these politicians? If you've got nothing to hide, why are you reacting so draconianly to the Pandora Papers revelations? Why are you stopping your own citizens from consuming this information? That's not just in Jordan, but in countries around the world where governments and politicians have gone out of their way to deny the accuracy of the Pandora Papers. You know, I've been on phone calls with politicians, literally looking at a copy of their passport from the Pandora Papers, looking at a copy of their bank statement from the Pandora Papers. And here they are on the phone, these politicians, telling me that I am lying and making up information. It's quite remarkable, but I think it shows just how important this kind of accountability investigative journalism is.
Well, and in countries... Go ahead, Evan.
No, I was just going to reinforce that point. I mean, if there was nothing to hide, why did they take down that that Arabic news site in their own country? Really, I mean, if there was nothing to hide, there wouldn't be a problem.
Well, in countries where you don't have systems in place where people can be held accountable for this, if a country like Jordan has the power to black out this media outlet and these leaders, these so-called leaders, tell you that, you know, they deny everything or they come up with some sort of excuse, then what, Will? What happens then?
Well, I think it's important to note that the offshore system doesn't operate just through one or two people. And this is what the Pandora Papers really tried to ram home as a point, is that a politician or a kleptocrat or a criminal, they are helped every step along the way in setting up a shell company or in buying luxury property in London or California through American, European, or Asian so-called enablers, you know, lawyers, accountants, real estate agents. And that was one of the big focuses that I did and wrote about in the Pandora Papers, was who are these lawyers in South Dakota, the United States, helping overseas billionaires and millionaires use the offshore system? And I think that potentially is where we can see impact and reform, because sure, the King of Jordan is a sovereign. He runs a state that has a widely feared secret service. So it's unlikely that you and I are going to wake up tomorrow and he will have resigned as a result of the Pandora Papers. But where things can change are, for example, rules or legislation in the United States that require higher standards of conduct from attorneys or real estate agents who work with people like the King of Jordan, for example. And we've already seen initial responses to this investigation in that very field. So there is hope.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I hope you can stick with us for a few more minutes. We want to talk about Sioux Falls. This was another incredible section of the documentary. Over the past decade, the amount of money in trusts in South Dakota from wealthy people who live overseas has more than quadrupled to more than $360 billion. And Evan, it was amazing to hear Washington Post reporter Debbie Senzipur, when she was on the ground in Sioux Falls, say that the skyline is just banks and trusts.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that Will worked with Debbie on very closely. And we were very, very interested in this from Frontline's point of view, obviously. It's a story in America's backyard, actually in the heartland of America, as it calls itself. And so the $360 billion, some of that is coming from Americans who want to basically put their money into a state which has a very low tax regime. The trusts can protect it from all sorts of things, including court cases in some cases. But it is also, as you correctly say, large sums of money are coming and washing through that system from abroad. And in fact, the documents reveal to us that as some of the more traditional tax havens, the sort of palm-fringed islands of the Caribbean, were tightening up their rules, forcing people to be more open about who the owners of these companies and trusts are, we see money going from there into South Dakota trusts. And we're doing that because the state over the past 10 years, as Will and Debbie found out in their reporting, were increasing the secrecy around these trusts. So it became very, very difficult for anybody from outside, including governments and investigators and creditors, from finding that money, from finding out who actually owns that trust. And as they found out in their investigation, there was more than almost 30 individuals who had been credibly accused or involved in wrongdoing in various forms who have money, you know, have money in these trusts. And that raised the question, how much more of that $360 billion comes from questionable sources?
Will, in our final minute, what has been the fallout from all of this? I mean, you all interviewed former State Senator Craig Kennedy, who said the trust industry has captured the legislature of South Dakota. They're designing a system that works well and is safe. So how are people responding? And first, can you just briefly tell us more about this trust industry? Who are these people?
So trusts are basically highly secretive legal arrangements that largely wealthy people use to control assets, reduce the taxes that they pay, and in some cases, avoid taxes or try to avoid paying child support. You know, you've probably all heard of wealthy husbands or wives who go through a divorce and then hide money from the person they're trying to divorce. That kind of happens, unfortunately, far too much. And South Dakota has become a world leader of these kind of trusts, not just within the United States, but globally. And I think, look, the Pandora Papers has really given South Dakota a bit of a black eye. We have heard that there are likely to be some changes to legislation in South Dakota next year, for example, just to make sure that some of these actors overseas with questionable backgrounds can't use Sioux Falls as they have so easily been doing for the past 5 to 10 years. And that's just the really tip of the iceberg when it comes to reforming the United States. The United States, let's not forget, is one of the world's biggest tax havens. Everyone's known that internationally for years. This is no big secret, but what the Pandora Papers has done has finally given meat or real examples to this in a way that I think will spur action, or that experts hope will spur action on a scale within the United States that hasn't happened before.
This is an important point because a lot of people often ask, why do so few rich Americans show up in these papers? And actually, a Forbes contributor, Jay Atkinson, wrote, wealthy people in the U.S. don't need to do this because the U.S. tax code is so favorable to wealthy Americans.
Yeah, and Jay's an expert in this kind of topic, and I think that's exactly right. There's that answer to it, but also there's the answer that, you know, 12 million records, it's a lot, but it's a drop in the ocean to all of the records that would convey all of what the world's rich and famous are up to. You know, we did find in the Pandora Papers references to Robert Durst, for example, the convicted killer in California, who some of you might have been following in the news recently. So there are wealthy Americans, but there certainly aren't as many as we'd expect, and there aren't American politicians or wealthy politicians, precisely for the reason that you pointed out, and also because there are a hell of a lot of other Pandora Papers investigations out there waiting for journalists like Evan and I to dig into in the future.
Well, huge thanks to all of you who have worked on the Pandora Papers. Will Fitzgibbon, senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. For 2 years, the ICIJ has led an investigation into these leaks. Thank you so much, Will.
Thank you.
Evan Williams is an award-winning print, radio, and TV journalist and one of the producers of the new Frontline documentary, Pandora Papers, which you can watch online now. Evan, again, thank you, and thanks to your team for putting together another great documentary. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the interest. Great talking to you again, Rose.
Likewise. Thank you so much. And you can find a link to Pandora Papers at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about COP26. Frontline groups say the final agreements contain woefully insufficient commitments on fossil fuels. So what do the agreements actually say? We'll be back after this.